Henry Story, habe ich das jetzt richtig ausgesprochen? Ich hätte vorher fragen sollen, ne? Tut mir leid. Super schön, dass du hier bist. Du erzählst uns jetzt gleich was auf Englisch. So I'm switching to English now.
Good.
For everybody, there will be a translation on the other audio stream and also here in the hall with the headphones. I see people here wearing headphones. Wonderful. You're telling us something about epistemology in the cloud. So epistemology, the thing with the nature of knowledge.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we're talking about the nature of knowledge in the cloud on fake news and digital sovereignty. And I'm really excited to hear about that. Big applause.
Thank you. How much time do I have about?
It's 5:11, so we can have like 5 minutes longer, so 40 minutes.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. Alright, so ich kann eigentlich auch gut Deutsch sprechen, aber ich will überall stecken bleiben in wichtigen Momenten und so werde ich auf Englisch sprechen, weil meine und so I'm going to speak in English. I might suddenly switch into German. Just remind me if I do that. So this is the overview of what we're going to speak about. Quickly, who am I? Then a section about what is epistemology, how is this related to privacy and agency. Then the architectural consequences we can draw from an epistemological view of the internet. And then bringing the public into the web, which I think is missing in a kind of very bizarrely overlooked part. Because you can't have privacy without publicity. Public, the public and the private are two dualities that come together. And finally, for the MetaLab people and the Viennese Freudian unconscious part that we are living in here, I'll try to speak a little bit about impossible worlds, if I have time. So my mother is Austrian, my father's English. We lived in France and America. I programmed since 1979 on DEC 2020. I studied philosophy. This brought me to AI and to philosophy. Then I ran out of money, so I came back to computing. I worked at Alta Vista, where the Babelfish machine translation service. And after that, I worked for Sun Microsystems on the Atom Protocol, on the semantic web research. It was a really good job, one of the best companies I've worked for. And then I've tried a startup. I've tried a few things now, doing a PhD to write all of this down. And this is the introduction to the PhD. So what is epistemology, or why we need decentralized computing? So epistemology is perhaps one of the first questions that were asked in philosophy. What is knowledge? So in modern language, you'd say something, modern philosophy, you write something like S knows that P, if P is true, right? You can't know something false. You have to believe it. You have to have some kind of relation to the proposition. You know, I've got £5 in my pockets. I know it if I have £5 in my pockets. If I believe that I have it, I would do something. I would put my hand in my pocket to get the money out. And if I'm justified in believing that P might be the old version. In 1960s, modal logic appeared, which allowed us to speak about possible worlds mathematically. So it comes from Leibniz. Leibniz was the first, but Leibniz got this from the, you could really argue, from the Chinese with the I Ching. There's some very interesting analysis of the I Ching as an algebra. But it took about until the 60s before possible worlds semantics became clearly mathematical and provable. So before that, speaking about possibilities was kind of a nebulous thing. And perhaps one way of looking at knowledge would be a very simple one, is that you know that P, if P is true, in all the situations that are compatible with your information. So that would be a... we can imagine, for example, two people coming to this event, coming from different directions. As they reach about 50 meters from this event, they have perhaps a meeting here in 3 minutes. They know that each one knows they're going to be there, so they're in world W. We have A and B, and for A, He can't distinguish between W and W, W and V, right? Because these are two situations. He knows that he's going to be on time, but he doesn't know if B is that B is going to be on time. So he knows he can't distinguish the situation where V is going to come or not come. So therefore, you would say that T knows that he's going to be there, but he doesn't know about his friend if he's going to be there. And so you can think of knowledge as I say, being able to distinguish, make sure that the proposition holds in all the situations you believe compatible. All right. Good. So, but there's actually a little problem. That's kind of good for lots of scenarios and lots of ways of modeling certain things. It's very interesting for thinking about knowledge, inter-group knowledge. But it has a problem, and that's coming to do with Alpha Centaurians. So now we move into science fiction. These are actually in the film from the film Mars, but we imagine that Alpha Centaurians come from another galaxy, and they come and they pick people up at night in a spaceship and take their brain out, put them in a vat, and give them the impression that they're listening to this conversation, right? So perhaps you all here are actually in a spaceship and listening to what is not really a talk about that I'm giving you, but a simulation of a talk about virtual reality. So since we can never exclude the possibility that we are not a brain in the vat, or that we're not dreaming, the question comes immediately: how can you know anything at all, right? The initial argument was we know something if we can exclude the situations which are incompatible with our knowledge, but we can never exclude the situation that we're dreaming or that we've been abducted by aliens. So the answer to this type of problem comes by looking at counterfactuals. The counterfactuals have a logic that was developed in 73 by David Lewis. And he looked at sentences like the following: if kangaroos had no tails, they would topple over. And his analysis was that this is true if in any possible state of affairs in which kangaroos have no tails, so change the world as little as you can from the actual world, and look if in those worlds they have or not tails. So we have like phi might be there. That you can think of propositions or sentences as sets of possibilities, or sentences, spaces of possibilities. Phi is all the worlds where kangaroos have no tails. The center there is I, is the actual world. And then you go as far as, you go, these circles are concentric distance relations from the actual world. How far do you go from reality to get to a world where kangaroos have no tails? And if all of them, like in that gray spot there, are psi worlds where they have they don't topple over, then you can say that's true. And so the nice thing is about this counterfactual, which is really important for thinking about engineering, because engineering is about thinking about what would happen if something was different from what it was, right? What happens if a car is driving down the street when you're not looking? It might not be there, but it's a good idea to look and to turn in your head to see if there's a car coming. So we're constantly in the world dealing with preparing ourselves for counterfactual situations. There's a book recently came out. This is a neighborhood semantics. This is being developed further. And Nozick used this to give the following definition. So someone knows that something, if it's true, if they believe it, and if it weren't true, they wouldn't believe it. So if I have £5 in my pockets, this answers the problem. So how does this answer the problem of the Alpha Centaurians? Is that, do I know that I have £5 in my pockets? I have them, I believe I have them, and if I didn't have them, it's because I would have bought another mate at the entrance there, not because Alpha Centaurians came and picked me up. So I can keep a distance relation between between the more likely situations I should be considering and the more far out ones. So that's the £5 in my pocket scenario. So that's how I can know lots of things, even though I never know for sure that I'm not in the situation of the Alpha Centaurians. So we can relax now, right? Well, you know. But what about if this were the case, right? What if the aliens were already here, right? You know, this was an ad that came out in 1999, San Francisco, a billboard. Led to all kinds of people on the street and created quite some chaos. But if they were here, we would be in an epistemological war. Right, because we would no longer know whether we are speaking to the people we think we are. We would give an order, but would we be sure that it's arrived? We might be reading a book, but and it has a mathematical formula that tells us this is that. But would we be sure? You know, so this advert has a couple of years ago reappeared in England. All right, but you might say, good, so all right, so of course this is an advert, they're trying to make money out of people humorously to get people to consider going to do a bit of exercise. They could have tried to do this all kinds of other way, but it's not serious, right? But, you know, is this not the situation we're actually in? You know, aliens coming from the cloud. So now we've externalized our memory and place those into computers and place those in the cloud, would we be able to tell if the memory had been altered? Perhaps we're thinking the value of what we post is not fat enough for it to be of interest to those who hold our memory in their possession. But what about the huge marketing industry that is feeding us individualized dreams based on our externalized memory? So they don't need to change the past in order to influence our actions. So this is the discussions we've had earlier about privacy, right? So this has already been presented in films like The Matrix. And this is, I think, the argument from agency that we can get from epistemology to agency about why we have to be careful about why we want to be worried about data being not in our hands, right? If we think about now the organizations, institutions, so individuals might be able to remember what they wrote somewhere, but institutions that are composed of millions of people or thousands of people that work together by putting their data into a computer, they can have workers change, leave the company, and the information that they have and that creates the memory is externalized, is completely externalized. So for an organization like telecoms or larger, or any kind of large organization to be able to subsist, it needs this externalized memory. So it needs to be able to know that this externalized memory is secured. So in ancient Greece, people would write the laws into the stone. As it moved away from bards remembering it by heart, they slowly moved to putting into stone. And it would have been quite difficult to come out at night and hit the stone and change the laws. We would have woken people up in Athens. Whereas doing that, as we said earlier, in silicon is quite easy. So what this brings us to is to think about the whole web as a stack, which I call the cooperating system stack. We need to have open hardware at the layer, at the top bottom layer. We need open hardware, which is going to be a freedom box, or for a company, their own computers, or for the government, for the military, their computers that they can put into bunkers and make sure is not being accessed by people who shouldn't be, right? Now, the freedom box was initially put forward by Eben Morgulen, who gave a very good talk on this kind of problem in 2011 or something like that. But it hasn't really gotten that far because we're missing something. So we need to be able to control our memory. That's this computer. We need to be able to do that on a platform that our friends can inspect the code of. So it has to be an open source operating system, right? So that there's no Trojans. We need to have secure cryptography, but we also need to be able to communicate with other people who are in the same situation. So we have to think of the architecture in a Kantian kind of, what is it called, categorical imperative. Everybody should be following the same rules. So if I want free privacy and I want to be able to have control my thinking, I should create an architecture where everybody else can do that. And if everybody else has their computer in their home or in the bank or and their data there, and they don't want to be completely isolated, they need to be able to work together. So why is this, what's missing? So this is where I'm trying to get at. What's missing? Well, we have the internet is a peer-to-peer system. Packets are shipped from one computer to another over the whole internet. And actually, in that way, there's lots of improvements to be made, but it's a peer-to-peer system. There's no problem with that layer. The web is a peer-to-peer system. Anybody can set up their web server, put documents on it, link to other documents that are on other people's servers, and that's fine. That's working. Everybody can do that. You can have one browser, any number of browsers, Firefox, Safari, Chrome, browsers on your telephone, browsers on devices that haven't existed yet that can read this data, and they're not tied to any company. The problem comes with the data. Currently, our applications are tied to the data that's tied to a company. These companies at the layer of the data control the whole data, even though they work on the IP layer that's completely distributed and the HTML hypertext layer that's also decentralized. So that's why in Facebook you can link to videos, post on YouTube, you can link to Twitters, to documents about from academia. But the applications themselves are tied to this one server. And so what we want to do is to break that piece, which is the bottleneck, by turning every application into a browser. So we want to move from applications that are central-based to hyper-applications. So just as the browser can look at web pages on any every website, future hyper-data-based applications, like the browser as a hyper-text application, would be able to go to any website and read and write data, so mostly read data, follow links to other websites. So for example, get a profile from a company, link to a university, then from there make a meeting with someone at a at some community organization. In such a way that the application was would work exactly the same way, but just vary depending on the data, for any kind of domain. And this is what Tim Berners-Lee's Solid project is about, which I've been working on for a while. This is what his new, well, actually for 10 years, he's been working on this for 30 years about. If not longer, getting the whole semantic web standards going, getting all the pieces going to get to here. And and now you started a startup because for some reason people don't seem to be taking the initiative, even though people like me have been speaking about it for a while, to do it themselves. So we'll see what he does with it. But just to explain a little bit, how does this type of thing work? It's just data where every concept is identified with a URI. The description of the URI is located at the location of the URI, and that maps into reality by describing, for example, in this case, Tim in the world. Tim has a telephone. The document about him says that he has a phone, so I can find out by calling him. I can causally connect to him using a phone. That's how you can, for example, tie in a description into the real world. You can then add access control and authentication by having descriptions for every resource in RDF describe who can access it. And this can describe who can access it by pointing to people on other who have their profiles and public keys published on other servers. And this is So this is his interrupt. I don't really know much about it. I've just heard him come up with that recently. And this is the, now we can understand the full stack. At the bottom we have the open hardware. Then there's and the operating system, and on that the social link data server, which does the access control, which is just a web server plus access control, plus read-write. And it's pretty much that's all it is. The web is just all the aggregation of all of these servers with links between them. And the human interface, the applications, are the ones that human beings use to interact. So when we want to make a meeting, we might use an application because we want to make a meeting. And these applications will write data into different distributed databases and connect these data in such a way that anybody who wants to compete and build a better application will be forced, like people who wanted to get into the web, to write a browser that uses the same vocabulary. Because why start with a new vocabulary when there's already a growing community of people who are using the vocabularies that are so widely used, in which there's understanding about how to use it. So in my PhD, I'm going into more detail on that. So that's solid. And the funny thing is that we can start using this stack, this cooperating system stack, to think a little bit further about what's missing currently in the security of the web. For example, there is a company called Company House. There's a website called Company House. It has a URL in the United Kingdom. Currently, nowadays, it's very easy to get an HTTPS connection automatically. You don't have to pay anymore. So a lot of people are, and a lot of spammers are too. But so the question is, we'll get back to epistemology, is if you're English, you might know that Company House is where companies register. But if you're English, how do you know if that's the same thing? Right? You've got no idea. You can't exclude that this is a pirate site, so you don't know. You might go to, if you're Austrian, go to the Company House, look at the SSL certificate, and it will tell you one piece of information, and one piece only, is where the headquarters are located. So, I know, but my guess is that South Glamorgan doesn't tell you much, right? And probably even less to Japanese or to Americans. And that they might see, you know, they see GB. Some people might not even know that GB is Great Britain. So this information is completely uninteresting, and that's why nobody uses it. But what if my site cooperating systems, when I did an HTTP get on it, when the browser did an HTTP get on it, had a link to the Company's House website, to its profile, and the browser understood the vocabulary that wouldn't just be JSON, but perhaps JSON-LD, which is JSON with a semantics behind it based on linked data. And the browser would then go to Company House and fetch all of this rich information about the company that's there live. So every time it can get the latest, it can find out who the owners of the company are, if they are, if they have legal trouble, if they've changed hands, and so on. All of this could be listed there. So now we don't just have the address of it. We have the websites. We have the browser. Something the browser can show the user. So the first time he would come to this website, he could give something interesting: profiles of the owners, investments, the stock market value, or perhaps if it's a local chocolaterie in Paris, there's some really good ones that where the owner got his chocolaterie mastership at. Because you have to make something original. It's like a doctorate in making chocolate. So you might want to know what he did it in. So, but if you're so you come to Company House, and how do you how does the browser know that Company House is a reliable source? Well, it could do the same kind of following the chain by the browser could follow the chain to gov.uk, and if you're a UK citizen, you might have put this as your trust anchor into your browser. But if you're German or Austrian, sorry, I haven't put Austria down there. I didn't have time to redo my slides. But if you're German, your browser could then follow the links in a web of nations to the Austrian trust anchor. So you would then feel secure because now your browser has a link to your trust anchor, and you have the diplomatic power of your nation behind you to help you give you information about the website you're on. So you don't no longer need Amazon or these very large companies who've spent a huge amount of money getting Amazon.com or Apple.com into your brain. You can now start having relationships with much smaller entities in a trustworthy way. So that gives us just an interesting missing piece, right? The whole part of institutional web of trust is missing from the web. And it's probably because people kept wanting to privatize it, but there's no reason to privatize that. Every government and every state in the world has these registries, and the most advanced ones already got them in JSON. So it's just a question of getting these people to agree on an ontology that the browsers can implement. So here's now we still have a few things that we can worry about, right? So I'm going to give you another one. So I'm going to read this. We learn very young to distinguish between what someone says and what we believe. We distinguish between Donald says, I'm a great salesman, and Donald is a great salesman. Thus we keep track of why we believe things. Was it my friend who sang the praises of the salesman at the door? Or was it the salesman who told me that my friend had done so? Or did he perhaps prove this by showing me a document from the Trump University? This is known as keeping track of context. Who said what? What evidence did they show to support their claim? Perhaps he does not need to. If I buy his line, if I buy whatever he says, then is he not a great salesman? If I'm a fish and I bite, does not that make the fisher great? So this notion of where we get the information, and so you know, the salesman always trying to get you to believe that they're the greatest salesman, and they do that by various devices. And there's a technological version of that, and that was, for example, demonstrated in 2002 by Zeye and Smith, and they showed a browser like this. And if you look carefully, you'll see that what they did is they just put pictures of the browser Chrome at the top, and that this is coming from a completely different website. So they made it look like the browser that you're looking at is a browser, when in fact it's just an image of a browser in a browser. A bit like the salesman trying to tell you that your neighbor said that he is the greatest salesman and that he's lovely. So this notion of context is really important. And if you think about it, when you go to a website and you have, since any application can fully take over your screen, you don't actually know for sure if you're using an application that you think you're using. So we can tie this in now to, so the way of keeping context is to keep track of who said what, these bubbles in comic strips, you know. You have a picture, you have a bubble, and you show who said it, right? And so since now on a computer like this, the whole screen can be taken over. Well, we noticed that Apple now has a second screen, and this could be a very interesting place to put the data about which application is running from the official registry of that website, so that you would know when you're going to a website. This doesn't deal with individuals, right? So, but it deals with public companies, that you know that you're going to that website so that you can give them the information and that you know that you're not being scammed. So you don't need to go to the mega companies that will tell you that you can be secure with them. So that's my story. And then, do you have a little bit more time? Uh-huh. Oh. Okay, 10 minutes. Oh well, and I'll add a little fun piece to this. All right, so here. I talked to you about possible worlds and possible world semantics. And the problem with possible world semantics at the limit when you start looking at it is that everybody knows all the consequences of what they think. And every mathematical truth has the same meaning, namely the set of all possible worlds. So it turns out that it's very useful to have impossible worlds to deal with that. At least that's one way of dealing with it. But if we want to look at... where's my... Oh, here. Can I get my, I can't get my, oh, here it is. Huh. Oh, it's really difficult. Oh, I see. I can. I have to click on this. You're right. Oh, I know. I can mirror displays, and then it's easier. Well, the picture I was showing earlier, right there. It's an artwork by Michael Craig Martin in 1973. He has a glass, and on that he has a jug, and he puts some water in it. And the text next to it essentially is him having a dialogue with some kind of interview with some interviewer, and he argues that this is not a glass of water, but it's an oak tree. And it's quite detailed. This is not an oak tree. This is not a glass of water. It looks to like everybody like it's a glass of water, but it really is an oak tree, not metaphorically. And it's quite funny piece of text. So it's conceptual art. I'm linking there to this is on my Twitter account to an article that came out just last year called "Impossible Worlds and the Logic of Imagination." So it's kind of tied together. The funny thing, so perhaps I don't need to click on that, you can go and look at it, but the funny thing about this story is in that tweet a little bit further down, this was discussed, there's a story about this. So the question is, does impossibility have an impact on the world? Or is it just fiction of your imagination? And it turns out that Michael Craig Martin tried to go to Australia with his work of art, and they sent it back because they don't allow vegetation into the country. So this appeared in an article in The Spectator in 2002. The person who wrote this story won a prize by three members of the Spectator jury, one of which was Boris Johnson, who gave the prize for because the prize was to anybody who could prove that conceptual art could be interesting. So Boris Johnson, which you know is our Brexit person, who's always got crazy hairstyles and looks completely out of it, gave a prize for this piece of conceptual artwork on impossibility. And there's a fun story there also about Theresa May's Brexit story, where it's from the BBC, a comedy where they show how clearly this is nearly an impossible task, since one side wants to be in and one side wants to be out. So I'll leave you to look at that, and then I can take now some questions.
Okay. Thanks, Henry. It was a pleasure to have you here. Are there any questions in the room? Yeah, you have one? You can take mine as well. Okay.
Thank you very much. And I think what you're doing is crucial to what is the emerging issue in an apparently unrelated field, and that's stock investing. I think that in a scenario perspective, the robustness of the results generated by the data economy are being questioned more and more. And these results are predicated on the reliability of the memory they have. The layers of separation and therefore of epistemic weakness that you have between, you know, these big memory repositories and the results that you draw from them are becoming the one issue. And we see a decay, for instance, in the effectiveness of Google queries, for one. So what you're doing is crucial in that side. The second point I have, what you propose is fascinating, but it's something like the hare and the tortoise. It's because what we're seeing is a realignment of the web, a renationalization and a balkanization of the web. And from what I understand, what you're proposing seems to just fly overhead all this, whereby state actors bypass, to a certain extent, or a semantic layer where state actors play a crucial role as repositories that bypasses this, let's say, the commercial level, except that, of course, you have this issue with realignment of the web. So am I wrong, first of all? That's my question. And how, if I'm not, how would you address that? Thank you.
So very large data sets have to deal statistically with the data, because like Google, they've got so much data, they don't know what's true or false, they can only make statistical inferences about things. On the other hand, if I have my address book and I meet any one of you and we use it for business, then it's quite important actually that the data be true. I don't make a statistical judgment about, am I going to statistically meet someone? And you can't, when you don't come, say, well, statistically I did. It just didn't turn up this time, but I would have done in all the other possible worlds. So there is a distinction between, a lot of people go and think statistically because they're thinking in terms of Google, but Google only became big, I used to work at Alta Vista, because people started publishing documents first. So it's the first act is publishing documents and having a relation with other human beings, and these provide services on top of it. And I think this is the same. Reason why the semantic web has to start from a game of coordination between people to do certain things, coordinated by hyper applications. What I'm doing here with this thing here with the Web of Nations is just saying these. For example, a company house already exists. It already puts its data in JSON. It's just a question now of getting the browsers who know that they have a huge phishing problem, that nobody looks at the SSL certificate, to just coordinate with the countries who have the legal apparatus to take people to court, to change the law, and so on. So that the people who should be maintaining the list of the companies and who are the universities and which are the institutions of knowledge, which is the meteorological office. Well, that seems like something their countries should legislate, and they can, of course, give it to private companies if they feel like they can take over it, and if they're intelligent like the United States, they create standards and then they give it to a private company, and if the private company doesn't deliver, they change because it's standard based, and so the company just has to compete on quality. So here I'm. This is the way to stop nationalization is to deal with the issues that countries are having. To deal with it, they feel like they don't have any leverage, and the way to give them the leverage is to bring them back into the browser, but without centralization, right? So until now, the United States thought, I think unconsciously, that it would be the big owner of all of these companies and it would set the standards. And that's it doesn't work anyway. You know, China doesn't want it, Russia doesn't want it. It's too far away from democracy to be a good thing. So it's much better to have a decentralized web of nations, where we already know how to go to vote, and we already know who our local people are, and we know the crazy ideas for example, the Brexiteers, what all kinds of impossible worlds people are imagining. We know our local people, and we know how to deal with them. But you know, you don't want English people to make laws in Austria because they've got no idea what kind of crazy ideas you have, and they'll just make the wrong laws. Because mostly we're dealing with people having, politics is about people having completely incompatible ideas trying to come to an agreement, right? So Brexiteers want to leave the EU and the others want to stay inside, and so Theresa May is trying to be inside and outside at the same time. So we need so the semantic web is very beautiful because it allows, it's not like the blockchain. So we have a trust, right? We have this 1A chain from an individual server to company house. Then we have another chain from that to gov.uk. Then we have a number of chains to, these are chains, but they're not blockchains. They don't require global agreement and global synchronization of the truth. If you have a trust anchor that's Austria, you might have even many. You might say, I think Austria is good and Switzerland's too. And I would like the browser to take both of them, give me the and tell me if there's any kind of disagreement, and let me choose. Or perhaps you, like me, I'm English. I'm English, but my mother's Austrian, lived in France. Perhaps I'd like all those three trust anchors. for when I do business in different countries. So you allow there to be disagreement, you allow there to be different points of views, you allow there to be different police, different military, because it's well, it's a hypersystem, so it allows different it's a database which is allows different points of views to coexist, and what you believe the truth is then decided by your trust anchor. And of course, you can also play games in virtual worlds and decide that for the purpose of a game, you believe the Earth is flat, or and use your same address book to make meetings with people in some kind of virtual world, using a virtual time. So you can imagine how this allows you also to use the same tools you do to do your day-to-day life in virtual reality. You want to meet with trolls on a certain place, so you can attack some kind of, I don't know.
Okay, thanks. Question answered. That's fine. We could take a very short question if there is one.
How do you see the changes that Barnes-Lee and your proposal will be adopted? Because there are big financial interests against establishing a peer-to-peer system.
yeah, so there's big. So I mean, there's big financial interests, but there's the German army, the French army, the if you realize the size of the things that are in question, there are other very big players. So once you have, and these players can't use Facebook, right? And because of GDPR, most institutions in Europe can't have, and it wouldn't even work if they used Facebook to make medical decisions. Right, it's not the right platform. So you have to think, in 1992, when Microsoft, the same question would have been asked in 1992: how are you going to deal with Microsoft? It is so big, it is so large, it has Word, and you can't do anything. Well, it wasn't hyperlinked, so the network effect of that system was much smaller than the network effect of the and then there was political interest by Clinton and Al Gore to push this. So you need political interest, but that political interest is growing with the GDPR, and also you need prototypes. Tim Berners-Lee has got all of the connections to build these. The standards are there, so really it's a question of playing along, trying it out. We're kind of in a new, in the same space we were in 92 when the browsers were being, new browsers were being developed and played with.
Analogous to the browser wars?
Well, there could be, one could have a completely different startup philosophy that instead of investing in one company that has to take it all, you could invest in applications that can work together, so that you don't have to. You could have an application for doctors that would allow them to better work with other doctors, and because that works together with the calendaring data that's published, all of these are in fact working together and enriching the system. So I think for a long time we had a bit of a browser war, but the web was growing so fast that was peanuts compared to really the amount of coordination that was going on globally. And we still have about 5 or 6 browsers, right? So I think the field is completely open. The Americans have the disadvantage that they're so big, but the Europeans have the disadvantage of being so incredibly slow.
Thanks.
So thanks a lot, Henrik. It's a pleasure to have you here. Quite an impressive talk and also quite impressive biography. I don't know if you read it in his biography in the program. You also developed Babelfish, and I think that's the reason why your Twitter handle is also Babelfish, but spelled BBL Fish. Yes, and you should follow him. He's not also a great fan of XKCD, of the famous XKCD, as we all know. Yeah. But you have quite of interesting content along your Twitter. Give him a great hand. Thanks.
Thank you very much.